From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a new gilded age in America when the poor and much of the middle class can scarcely imagine the wealth and lifestyles of their top-tier countrymen. Over the past 30 years, the salaries of the country's top CEOs skyrocketed to more than 1,000 times the salary of the average employee. Political scientists long thought that democracy would stand as a bulwark against plutocracy in America, but that isn't happening. In this hour, why democracy isn't attacking the great American class divide. We begin with news from Washington on the pending power shift on Capitol Hill. Today's Washington Post reports the GOP plans a vigorous push on conservative social policies when Congress reconvenes in January. Jim Vandehei wrote the story. I asked him to outline what's at the top of the GOP's social agenda.
Well, I think there's a pretty long list of things Republicans would like to do on the social front, but several that Republicans are talking about in general are trying to pass a limit or outlaw so-called partial birth abortions.
These are late-term abortions, I guess, is another way of saying it.
Correct. Trying to expand the role that religious groups, you know, faith-based groups, as the White House calls them, play in administering social programs such as drug programs, alcohol programs, programs to feed the hungry. And then the welfare bill, which I think is going to have a whole host of different issues sort of embedded in it, programs that promote fatherhood and try to promote or encourage states to promote their own programs for two-parent households.
Jim, take us into each of these. First, abortion. What may be on the table when people come back? What are the dynamics? And how do the issues of appointments to the judiciary and legislation interact?
They play a big role. I mean, bottom line is, in the abortion fight, that this is really one that's waged in the courts. Republicans know that. Democrats know that as well. I think this is why you see so much anger, so much emotion when we talk about who's getting appointed to the federal bench, because at the end of the day, it's the people that are interpreting the laws that are having the biggest effect on abortion. What Congress wants to do, what conservatives in Congress want to do, is sort of force the court's hand, give the anti-abortion forces some greater standing in the courts. I think the one issue that you'll definitely see action on early this year is to ban late-term abortions. It looks like there's always been enough votes in the House. It now looks like there's 62, give or take, votes in the Senate.
Republicans also want to amend federal law to allow a person who violently harms or kills a pregnant woman to be charged for a separate offense in killing or harming an unborn child. Why the focus here?
This is a big issue for the anti-abortion movement, and I think it's probably a little more difficult to get through Congress because it is so controversial. The anti-abortion forces would like to get it because, in the end, they really want to establish in law, but also in the minds of voters, that a fetus is a human being. And the more they get this written into law, into government policy, and get people talking about it, the better chance they think they have, you know, many years down the road to overturning Roe v. Wade. I don't think anyone thinks that's going to happen in the short term, but, you know, the more conservatives you get to the bench, particularly if there is an opening on the Supreme Court, you know, in the next couple of years, like everyone has been speculating there will be, this gives the anti-abortion forces hope.
And let's talk about appointments to the judiciary under a Bush administration with an all-Republican Congress. Do you have a sense of how many positions are open and how it might swing the weight of judicial opinion if and when Bush's nominees are approved?
I don't know the precise number. There are several that are open. There's several that have been held up. I think this is one of the great powers that the president has, and this is something that he's really tried to do and get more conservative voices. I don't think they go out and say, you know, we're recruiting anti-abortion and judges to appoint them to the bench, but in the end they tend to appoint more conservative judges, you know, and always sort of with an eye on what they'll do if there is a Supreme Court opening.
What are the details of the faith-based involvement in government service? Where are they looking to really make material changes there?
Well, this has been a big issue for the president himself. Essentially, he wants to make it easier for faith-based groups, religious groups, be they Christian groups or Muslim groups or whatever, to be able to get federal funding to help administer some social programs. The president believes that the churches, particularly in the inner cities, are more effective sometimes than sort of the non-religious entities at administering these, but that because of federal law and because of worries about running afoul with church and state laws and also in the Constitution, they've been less inclined to do it. What the president wants to do is he wants to make it clear that religious groups can compete for these contracts to get government money, as long as they're not trying to convert people to their religion, but as long as they're providing a social service, that they're allowed to win this government money to perform it.
Does he now have the votes to do that in Congress, and is congressional approval enough, or does he again here need approval from the courts?
In this case, I think congressional approval would be enough. There's already a very, very small percentage of government money that does go to social groups. I think if he can get this written into law, and it should be easier with a Republican Congress, it will probably expand it. Nobody keeps statistics on how much government money goes to faith-based groups, so we don't know if he was successful in expanding it over the last 2 years.
And on the welfare front, what kind of welfare legislation might be promoted by the Bush administration now that they have a majority on both sides of the Congress?
Right, and the president sort of laid out his plan last year, and I think it'll be the same plan. They're reauthorizing the 1996 welfare law, which everyone thought was really effective and did a great job of getting more people from welfare back to work. It's going to become a fight over funding. The president doesn't think that you need to expand government funding to continue the success of the welfare program despite the downturn in the economy. And then as part of this much bigger fight, you'll have all these social fights about should the government be providing grants to states to promote fatherhood, for instance. It's not a great deal of money, but it's sort of the theory or the policy behind it that seemed to agitate Democrats. That will definitely be another flashpoint.
This is promoting fatherhood, promoting marriage, promoting abstinence.
Right. Promoting abstinence, which has always been a big cause of the religious right, and there seems to be a lot of government figures of late that there's been some success in this movement that teenage pregnancies are down slightly, and that, you know, this is really becoming a rallying cry for the Republican Party that you need to, you know, as much as providing condoms in schools, you need to be offsetting that by teaching children not to have sex at all, and they want to get more funding in this area.
Jim, what's the pressure on the Bush administration now? Are Bush's Christian fundamentalist backers coming now and saying, hey, these issues are past due, let's get going? How sharp is that pressure?
They are, and I think there's always been this tension inside the Republican Party, and I think it might even be exacerbated by the elections about who is the base of the party. Is it evangelical Christians, or is it the big businesses that contribute the money and sort of provide the infrastructure for the party? A lot of the Christian groups feel like they were sort of the backbone of the party in these elections, that they provided the margin of victory, if you will, in key races in places like Missouri and Minnesota and other areas where these Senate races were decided by a few thousand votes. And I think they would like to see movement on this agenda. You know, on the other hand, the president knows that, if anything, these elections were probably decided by the whole climate of the war on terrorism and the possibility of war in Iraq, and that he's very popular as a result of his handling of both situations. A little reluctant to overplay his hand at this point. He'd probably prefer to downplay it.
Jim VandeHeide, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
Jim VandeHeide is a reporter with the Washington Post. He spoke with me from Washington. The signs are everywhere. It is a new gilded age. The 13,000 richest families have incomes equal to America's 20 million poorest households. Wealth differentials are even greater. But even as the disparity between the rich and the rest grows more pronounced, the poor and middle class are not rising up. In an era of super class distinctions, Democratic pushback is a no-show. Our guest tonight says the have-nots can't even imagine the lives of America's haves anymore, that democracy may quail before such a concentration of wealth. What do you think? Why the silence? Do we all think this is just hunky-dory? Do we each think our own jackpot is just around the corner? Is American democracy ignoring the gap? Is it accepting it? Or is it paralyzed by it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Ian Shapiro, professor of political science at Yale University and the author of Democratic Justice. He's also author of Why the Poor Don't Soak the Rich in the winter issue of Daedalus. Good evening and welcome, Professor Ian Shapiro.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us.
Also, I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Ian Shapiro, you've laid out such an interesting perspective here, and we're eager to dive into it. It seems to us that we were talking about it today that the reigning view of why Americans through most of the 90s anyway, have not been upset about disparities in wealth and income has been the notion that this is part of the triumphant capitalistic system, and that it eventually lifts all tides, that it may even be an engine of growth to have concentrations of wealth. But you paint a picture in your forthcoming article, or I guess coming out now, that's more subtle than that. And you take us back and say that the original thesis was that democracy would be naturally redistributive, that it would naturally tend to push politically to redistribute resources and wealth. You say not only has that not happened, but now as we see a new Gilded Age or Age of Disparity, citizens of this democracy seem to be less able or willing than ever to push back politically against the gap.
Yes, I think that is the case. There are many reasons why democracies don't redistribute downwards in the way that both friends and opponents of democracy feared would happen in the 19th century. But I think that the things you're referring to do particularly have to do with why it is that people don't seem to demand more downward redistribution. You might think intuitively that the more unequal the society becomes, the more likely it is that the poor would rise up and demand downward redistribution.
Like a powder keg.
Yeah, but paradoxically, it may be that the opposite is the case, that as things become more and more unequal, a variety of things happen. One is the growth of what I call empathy gulfs. And here the thought is that you can imagine yourself stepping over a puddle. You can imagine yourself even perhaps swimming a river unaided, but not crossing the Atlantic on your own.
Take that metaphor apart for us.
Okay. Well, the thought is that if the gap between the rich and the poor becomes sufficiently great, it no longer becomes possible for poor people to imagine themselves in any kind of realistic way in the shoes of the rich. If your entire lifetime income couldn't buy a yacht that perhaps you're repairing or cleaning, the notion that you could yourself become the owner of that yacht simply becomes unreal to you. And then I think that the empathy gulf notion operates in the other direction as well, that if you are so wealthy that you simply can't imagine that no matter what kind of calamity might befall you, you can't imagine yourself ever getting into the condition of a street person, let's say, then it becomes much easier for you to tune that person out and not take them seriously. There's no sort of there but for fortune go I rationale for humanizing them or taking them seriously. It's much easier to move to the suburbs or to gated communities and essentially allow the poor to deal with one another in the inner cities.
That makes the move to such a gulf, such a gap, sound like a one-way street in a democracy.
Well, it may be. I mean, if you think about the one era in American history in the 20th century where there was significant redistribution from the rich to the poor, this was the after the Great Depression in the era of the New Deal. Mm-hmm. But what was present in that time that's absent today are two important things. One is the fact of the Depression created among elites the belief that capitalism might fall apart, that the wheels could come off the whole enterprise, as it were. Mm-hmm. Almost nobody believes that today. Secondly, there was out there an alternative competing model for the allegiance of the poor, namely the communist empire. Nobody believes that there is such an alternative out there today. So that the prudential reasons the wealthy and business classes had for getting behind and supporting the creation of the welfare state, which was essential for its creation, aren't there today. As I said, the empathy gulf operates in both directions. So the one historical example we have on record is not likely to be repeating itself at the present time, I think.
Ian Shapiro, you paint an incredible vista. We're going to dig into it this hour. We're delighted that you're with us. Listeners, we're talking about the vast new inequality in America's wealth and why there's no political pushback. Are we so isolated by income and wealth that we can't even feel the pain or the privilege of the other anymore. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the vast new inequality in America's wealth and income and why there's no political pushback, about rich and poor so far apart that they can't even see each other anymore. Our guest is Ian Shapiro. He's professor of political science at Yale University. He's author of Democratic Justice. The question is for you, should democracy work to level at least a bit the distribution of wealth in America or not? And in any case, why doesn't it? And do the poor even know how the American rich live anymore? Can the rich conceive of the life of the poor? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ian Shapiro, I wanted to put this question to you. I mean, there are many questions, but one just for starters. American television and American movies are absolutely chock-a-block with representations, depictions of lives of very affluent and rich individuals. The lifestyles of the rich and famous are right there. It cannot really be said that the middle class or poor don't have a view of what's going on at the top end of the scale. So how can they be inured or ignorant of it?
That's a very important observation. Social scientists make a distinction in the study of this matter between what they call knowledge by acquaintance and knowledge by description. And what that jargon means in plain terms is that knowledge by description, reading about something in the media or seeing it on TV or in a movie, doesn't have the same kind of reality for people as knowledge by acquaintance, as actually experiencing it in everyday life. It's knowledge by acquaintance that is real for people and moves them to action, that at some level, even though they see all of these things on television, somehow it doesn't influence their actual expectations from daily life, and those are governed by much more local comparisons that people make. For example, it turns out up and down the income scale that people generally compare themselves to people who are much more like themselves. So, for example, a college professor would be far more upset to discover that his or her salary was $2,000 a year less than the college professor in the office next door than he would be to discover that his or her salary were $100,000 less than the physician living next door.
Or $20 million less than the CEO 5 miles up the street.
Exactly. And by the same token, if you look at working class people, auto workers might compare themselves to steel workers in thinking about how well off or badly they are, but they don't compare themselves to the Lee Iacocca's of this world. And the notion that people make these global comparisons isn't supported by the evidence. It seems to be a fact of human psychology that people think on a more local scale and compare themselves with significant others that are much more locally defined. So even though they may see the life of the other 1% or 0.5%, it's not meaningful to them in any sense that actually influences what they do in politics or in daily life.
Jack Beatty, jump in here. I don't know about you, but I was always taught that my family came to this country to escape societies of tremendous gaps in wealth and privilege and power. And here Ian Shapiro's painting a picture where we're back there and we're inured to it, even ignorant of it at some level.
Excuse me. Yes, we have empathy gulfs. I fell into one of those gulfs the other day. I was reading about Denise Rich, the aptly named Denise Rich, who is connected to, I think, was the wife of one of the people most controversially pardoned by Bill Clinton at the end of his administration.
Right.
Well, she's being sued by her former manager. And he had to list the things he had done for her. One of the things he had done for her was he had reduced the amount she spends on flowers every year by $125,000. I fell into that empathy gulf. I couldn't imagine a life where you could hire someone to reduce your expenditures on flowers by $100,000, which assumes you still spend more than that.
That's a few bucks. Jack, look at the history with us here. Do you see waves in American history where the not
gilded portion of society uses the rungs of politics, pulls the levers to change this, or is it a one-way street, apart from the New Deal example that Ian Shapiro talked about?
Well, the great example, the largest mass movement in American history was the populist revolt of the late 1880s and early 1890s. By 1890, there were 3 million members of the Alliance Party in the South alone. 3 million would be equivalent to 15 or 20 million today. And the populists, essentially, they attacked all the shibboleths of the Gilded Age, and they helped their members pierce the veil, the illusion of inevitability. That, Barrington Moore says, is where the sense of injustice begins, where people begin to see that their lot is not inevitable, that what is not what has to be. And they did this, the populists did, by essentially sponsoring their own counterculture. Mm. They sent out 40,000 lecturers who essentially reread the world for its members and explained, no, what you're reading in the newspapers is all propaganda. They had their own newspapers. They had their own books and novelists. And they built up this alternative sort of intellectual and ideological machine that could challenge at every level the shibboleths of the Gilded Age. And it was this that we lack today. It's almost impossible to imagine escaping from the monoculture of our mass media. It holds us all in its grip, and it inculcates in us intellectual and political orthodoxy. So I think that's one of the great That's another factor I would add to Professor Shapiro's list of why the poor don't soak the rich.
And yet, Ian Shapiro, I can remember very well in my youth traveling a lot in third world countries, seeing the walled homes and compounds and broken glass along the top of the walls and the enormous gulf, and thinking, thank God that's not America. Thank God I live in a country where if you fall off your economic perch, you don't fall into a kind of hellish abyss of poverty. Now that can happen, and one would expect pushback. You talk about framing effects. I wish you'd explain that, how the whole view of what's going on can be framed in ways that kind of paralyze action.
Yeah, sure. I think that the points just made about the media are important, but what you mentioned raises another whole set of issues. It's certainly true that the sort of Brazilianization of America may be part of the wave of the future. One interesting empirical datum for you might be to note that we usually think of gated communities as communities of the ultra rich, but in fact, if you look at the statistics on the explosive growth of gated communities in the U.S. since the mid-1990s. Mostly it's been lower middle class and middle class gated communities, so that one of the ways in which the current system maintains itself is through middle class and lower middle class fear of the people below them. Mm-hmm. It's not so much the rich versus the poor is a very misleading in some ways, because
yes,
the great bulwark between the rich and the poor is the middle class. And so if you think of any number of issues that cause the middle class to identify with those above them rather than with those below them, They're the sorts of things that people refer to in politics as wedge issues. You know, we think about affirmative action, for example. The trench warfare of affirmative action is really what goes on as regards promotions in the police department and the fire department. It has no effect on people who live in Beverly Hills.
But I'm guessing, Ian Shapiro, that if you went out and talked to Americans, this is a pure hypothesis on my part, mm-hmm. but I'm guessing they would say, you know what, yes, they are rich and yes, they are poor. This is America.
Yep.
Some people, get their American dream, and I hope I get mine one day, and that's just the way it is. And all in all, I can even hear Americans saying, we're better off for this because it provides incentives that lead our economy forward. What about it?
Well, first of all, part of that may be true. It may indeed provide incentives that do lead the economy forward. But the fallacy in the argument is it's not that we're seeing the growth of inequality and the political system is just standing by. You need to understand that the political system is often intimately involved in the spread of inequality and the increase in inequality. Because while it's certainly true that democratic political systems such as ours don't redistribute very much from the rich to the poor, it's completely false to say that they don't redistribute. The federal government distributes tens and tens of billions of dollars to various groups every year, but they're groups that are well organized and know how to use to work the system and use the media. For example, the Farm Bill that was passed earlier this year is an enormous, essentially federal handout, massive redistribution through the federal government. Likewise, the prison bills that get passed involve huge amounts of redistribution of wealth to the people who run prison prison industries, increasingly private sector prisons, and so on.
There's something you say on prisons that I really want to get to, and we have a lot of callers I want to go to soon. But
sure.
But before we do, if I'm reading you correctly, it seems as though you're saying that part of the way that the potential sting of backlash has been pulled from American democracy is by incarcerating millions of people, that we have record numbers of nonviolent criminals in prison, and this is a kind of way of taking tension or resentment off the streets and locking it up. Is that what you're suggesting, Ian Shapiro?
It operates directly in that way, and it also operates through the felon disenfranchisement laws, which exist in many states that permanently disenfranchise people who have been convicted of felonies, thereby reducing the political efficacy of those who might be making demands for downward redistribution.
So this is a pretty radical critique you're making, that America's power elite is, in effect, locking up potential opponents, political opponents.
Well, you know, the number of people in prison has gone up from about half a million 15 years ago to well over 2 million. That's a lot of people.
It is a lot of people. Chuck is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for an interesting show. I was intrigued by some of the comments about the media. I was wondering to what extent the guests thought that the fact that – now, keep in mind, I'm not a fan – of, or rather, an opponent of campaign finance reform, but to a certain extent, isn't speech and money related? Isn't money really speech? And in order to get some of these issues onto the agenda and get people thinking and discussing them, isn't it going to take some investment, you know, through the media to make those points?
Are you saying, Chuck, that the rich control our entire conversation, maybe even our internal dialogue, because they have more access to or more wealth to buy time to buy the message on the media?
Well, I'm not saying that anyone controls the entirety of what is discussed in the media, but certainly someone familiar with how the media works knows that frequency and reach can certainly change the way that people perceive the world, and you get the right message to enough people enough times, and it will impact the way that they relate to the world around them.
Yep.
And unless you can compete on that level, it's going to be kind of hard to move the needle a little bit.
Ian Shapiro, what do you make of this critique? Are we brainwashed by a media unduly influenced by wealth? Can democracy push back?
I'm also quite skeptical of talk about brainwashing and that sort of thing. I do think, though, that the Supreme Court's decision in 1976 in Buckley versus Valeo to equate money with speech was a disaster for American democracy, one of the worst decisions that has been made in the second half of the 20th century.
This opened the way for huge spending on political campaigns.
Yeah, and not because it brainwashes us, but simply because the volume of certain kinds of speech completely drowns out the volume of other kinds of speech and puts limits on what it is that people can actually hear. And that's, you know, for the reasons your other guest mentioned earlier on, that's an enormously difficult thing for people to contend with.
Ken's calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Tom and Professor Shapiro, perhaps one of the reasons Americans don't seem particularly upset about this is because we haven't, either generally or tonight, I think, really heard why it's such a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
I will cede you the point that 13,000 out of families out of 290 million Americans have an extraordinary lifestyle. But, you know, to me, an average American, so what? Why is it a bad thing to have a disparity of wealth, no matter how big it is? And let me just make the comment. I think that perhaps that view comes from an old idea that wealth is constant, so that, you know, the more somebody has, the less somebody else has. But
yeah.
That's one of the virtues of America. Wealth isn't constant. We're not rooted in wealth from the land, for example. We, you know, we create wealth all the time.
Ken, these are great questions, and hang in with there.
Sure.
While I put it to Ian Shapiro, I tried to raise just this issue earlier, but Ian Shapiro,
sure,
here it is,
I think,
right up as you might expect. What's the problem?
Well,
the so what question.
I think the caller is substantially right in that for many middle class people, they think, yes, so what? So there are plenty of rich people out there, but I'm doing okay, even if doing okay now requires both my spouse and myself to work 40, 50 hours a week. But we're doing okay. We're getting what we want. I think that the point is that the middle class generally does do okay. It's the poor I'm talking about, the bottom quintile of the population, people who are either living in poverty or in serious danger of falling into poverty. Those people are extraordinarily vulnerable in this economy. And it's those people who seem unable to manage to get the wherewithal for basic survival. And it's partly because the caller is right. It's partly because the middle class is doing okay, but under a certain amount of stress, feeling pinched, mm-hmm. that they become the bulwarks against redistribution to the poor.
Jack, what about this issue of turnover, if I can put that to you, Jack Beatty, of churn among the wealthy or near wealthy classes?
Well, certainly there's some churn there, but there's not much downward mobility in America. What's surprising in recent economic research is bringing this out is how little upward mobility there is in the country. There's a recent article by Herb Gintis and Sam Bowles that applies logarithms to the proposition and basically finds that we are, along with Britain, about the least mobile of the advanced industrial societies, quite contrary to the American myth. Now, this is a relatively recent phenomenon. There was a time when when social provision to education, when health care was not rationed as it is now, when in short, life chances weren't so unequally distributed, that wasn't nearly as true, and when taxes were tougher on the rich. But today, we actually have a situation where we're about to abolish for all time inheritance taxes that affect, well, that since 1960 have affected about 2% of the population and that affect every year 24 people in the state of Maine. But we're about to abolish those taxes, and that'll have to be made up by middle-class people. So, yes, it's a great country to be born a Bush or a Gore, but not so great for people who aren't so lucky in their parents.
We're challenging a lot of my impressions tonight, Jack. I always thought there was a lot of upward mobility. We'll come back and talk about it. We're looking at the inequality of America's wealth and income today and why there's no political pushback. Which way does the middle class empathy go today? Do they identify up or do they identify down? I'm at 1-800-423-8255. Join us. This is Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about inequality in America's wealth and income and why there's no political pushback, asking if the rich and poor are so far apart today that they can't even see each other. What do you think? Did you think in the 90s that the rising tide would lift all boats? Did it? And if it failed, what now? Are we evolving into an American caste system based on wealth? Can democracy fight that trend, if that is the trend? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Professor Ian Shapiro at Yale. He's author of Democratic Justice. David's calling from San Francisco. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, how are you? I am very interested in this topic.
predominantly because of the instinct aspect of it. The discussion is essentially revolved around why the poor don't stand up in outrage when they're cheated in such enormous ways. But if you look at it, money is not an instinct. And how could you get the sheer quantity of people to stand up and oppose something that is not instinctive? As well, when it comes to the complicated world, most people are, whether they're shy or cautious by nature, they don't take chances without some sort of proof of their position before they, you know, a good poker player holds their hand until they're sure whether or not to bet.
But David, there have been certainly large political movements in the past, and I don't know if it's all instinctive. I mean, if the guy who lives on the hill is living like a god and his children are getting an incredible education, and you're living in a ditch and your children are getting no education, is it really a matter of instinct looking at that?
Oh, I understand what you're saying, and certainly that's the case. When I was living in Colorado, two of my children died, and I'll tell you, you know, thanks to a lack of medical care, and the fury that I was living in every day made it much easier to have me or anybody else who had the similar happen to get arrested. So when you look at it, the filling the jails with the people who are subject to injustice, this is where it gets compounded. I was going to note a day or so from now is Buy Nothing Day, and when we are being impoverished on a daily basis, you know, here we're coming on the Christmas season and the layoffs are happening already, we can certainly boycott these big corporations, but we can also do it with a spirit of it's interesting. If we're not going to have any money anyway, we can, instead of telling our children that they can't have a toy, they can't have some item, we can just say we're boycotting it.
David, hold on. I want to put this all to Ian Shapiro. Ian Shapiro, I hear again here the difficulty of holding this vast mural in our minds all at once. I mean, the fact is, a lot of Americans have a lot of money, and a lot more have a good deal of money, certainly compared to a global comparison. Yet, David's pointing out, and we can all see, the pockets, and large pockets, where people do not. So what about his question about the instinctive response of humans to such disparities?
Well, I think we're all some mixture of instinct and social pressures and forces, but it doesn't seem to me that there's any reason to think that the poor are any more or less subject to instincts than anyone else. And, you know, one of my recurring points has been that other groups don't seem to have any trouble in extracting resources from the federal government, the farmers, the prison industry, the proponents of the estate tax repeal that your other guest was just referring, and mm-hmm. the list goes on and on. It seems to me less a matter of instinct than more a matter of organizational resources, perhaps some psychological resources, reference groups that I talked to before, who it is that people compare mm-hmm. themselves to, what sorts of expectations they have, and these things. And these are all eminently alterable in principle, and in different points in American history, they have been altered in the past. So it seems to me that these other things matter much more than just what one might put under the heading of instincts.
David, thank you for your call from San Francisco. Jack Beatty, Ian Shapiro quotes Tocqueville saying that the poor knuckle under in aristocracies because they are ignorant of comfort. Quote, they despair of getting it and they do not know enough about it to want it. Do you really think that America's poor are ignorant of what comfort is? And George Bush's whole educational push is no child left behind, which would seem to suggest to educate everyone well enough to understand what's going on.
I just think that people, the poor, we all are cross-pressured by on the one hand, our aspirations and our perceptions of injustice, and on the other hand, by the codes of individualism that we have internalized as Americans. And those isolate us. Those tend to make us blame ourselves. And that's a very heavy weight for someone to bear, so that when they look at the wealthy, They're apt to think, well, I didn't pass geometry in the eighth grade. They did, and look what that did for them. By God, if only I had studied harder. And they don't look at the whole system of injustice that was around that eighth grade. So I think that the individualism has been a cross in America for all radical movements. And as I say, the populists got through it by having a counterculture that taught people, wait a minute, you're not to blame because the price of cotton has gone from $1 a pound after the Civil War to 9 cents today. That's not your fault. Just that it's not your fault if you're losing your job to globalization.
Ian Shapiro, you point directly at this when you quote Ronald Reagan with his famous question in 1984, running for re-election, saying, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? You describe this as him requesting a self-referential comparison from voters.
Yeah, if you can get people to focus on whether their own condition has improved relative to what it was before, you immediately put two things on the table. One is looking to only that question rather than your relative position in the social order, and also, of course, the possibility that things might get worse, that things could go backward, rather than focusing on what you might achieve in the future. But I did want to add one comment to the points made about individualism, which I think are tremendously important, and that is we have tremendously contradictory attitude toward individualism, because on the one hand, it is the sort of official secular religion of American culture, and kind of challenging it is to touch a kind of third rail in American politics. And things like handouts to the poor and welfare queens and all the rest of it seem to be non-starters for those reasons. On the other hand, it's quite wrong. As much of what we've talked about tonight about the sort of return to much more of a caste society in the U.S. makes clear, it's quite wrong to think that many of the wealthy are getting their wealth as a result of individualism. The repeal of the estate tax is a case in point. Here, the estate tax was intended to make sure that people have to work for the wealth they get, and yet conservative and individualist people think it's perfectly okay that vast amounts of wealth will be given to people who've done nothing to get them. Likewise, as I don't want to keep harping on the poor old farmers, I don't really have anything against farmers, but, you know, the federal government writes huge checks to farmers for doing nothing, i.e. for not growing crops. Billions and billions, and we don't see these things as contradicting individualism. It's only somehow when we're talking about the poor that we worry about the contravention of the secular religion of individualist values.
Jack, I hear you there.
Well, I just wanted to add to his list crony capitalism. I mean, Harkin Energy, George Bush's whole career, Dick Cheney. These people stand for the fix.
Ian Shapiro,
that the fix is in, and that's not the market. That's who you know.
Ian Shapiro, we've just got 30 seconds left, but take us to the point of what you see. What's the problem? What's the outcome? Where does this take us that is bad, or are we already there?
Well, I don't believe that people change fundamentally in politics unless they have to. And it seems to me that it's very unlikely that this situation is going to change unless there's some crisis of the order of the Depression that will force us to change. As one of your callers said, the great majority of the middle classes in America are reasonably content with their lot, and it would be quite a mistake to suggest otherwise. They may be running harder to maintain that lot. They may need two incomes where they needed one, but that's the reality.
Ian Shapiro, you just open up a big field for us. We have to talk a lot more about it, but thank you for getting us on the path tonight. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Ian Shapiro is professor of political science at Yale University. He's author of Democratic Justice, the book, and author of, in the winter issue of Daedalus, Why the Poor Don't Soak the Rich. Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, preparing military families for the possible war in Iraq. This is On Point. As America's servicemen and women gear up for a possible war with Iraq, their families are making their own preparations, preparing for the prospect of months or years without their husband, their son, their mom. At Army bases across the country, a program called Operation Ready gives classes to the families of soldiers who face deployment. The classes cover everything from how to cope with loneliness to how to change the oil in the family station wagon. Kristen Fair coordinates the Family Readiness Program for the military's most deployed unit, the 10th Mountain Division in New York's Fort Drum. In this radio diary, she says the war on terror and the looming war on Iraq have brought new urgency to her job.
Pre-September 11th, it was focused on peacekeeping missions. The audiences were small because we were in peacetime, and people didn't really think that they needed to know about all this deployment stuff and when their husbands or wives got deployed. We are a lot busier than we were, and we do it, or at least I know that I do it, with a greater realization of what I'm teaching these people very well may, or in the case of after September 11th, you know, did come to reality, that they needed to be prepared because their husbands or wives went to Afghanistan. I mean, this is real life now. This isn't, we're not talking maybes. We're talking reality. And the audience realizes that. Some people are stressed and worried and anxious, I think would be the key word. But we just continue to stress that they are prepared both emotionally as well as physically for deployments, you know, that they spouses know where their marriage certificates are and their birth certificates for their children, and they know where and when to change the oil on their cars, and that they help to prepare their children for the possibilities of their parents being deployed. We do this always. We just probably emphasize it more when there are possibilities of deployments. Powers of attorney, driver's licenses, how they can get their ID card renewed if their husband isn't here or their spouse isn't here. Classes on how to prepare your children for separation, stress management, financial management, little things that, you know, a civilian may think is a little thing, but in reality, on a military installation, if you don't have a power of attorney, and if your husband is in Afghanistan for 6 to 8 months, you're in trouble. You know, there's a lot of things that you can't do to take care of your children. It's not big what-if questions. It's the down and dirty of how do they take care of themselves and their children. They're here very often by themselves. You know, I mean, they have their friends and the neighbors and the military resources that are here to take care of them. But they may be, you know, young families from all over the country. So they're here without family, without their spouse. They are single parents all of the sudden in a very cold, snowy place that can be depressing at times, especially if you're from Texas or California. And, you know, there's a whole other piece that you have to cope with. Yeah, they don't even know how to drive in the snow, you know, and there's nobody here to teach them. They don't think, but, you know, once we get to these spouses and we and they realize that there are places and the military takes care of their families, so they're okay. And we see that more and more families choose to stay here when their soldiers are deployed, which says great things for the Army taking care of their families.
Kristen Fair is Family Readiness Coordinator at Fort Drum outside Watertown, New York. Her husband, Frank, is a captain in Fort Drum's 10th Mountain Division. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...